Welcome in, kingly brothers and heroic husbands from around the globe. Welcome to this episode of the Be the Husband She Brags About podcast. In this episode, we welcome in Darren F. McGee. Darren is a grounded, down-to-earth therapist with many years' experience working with individuals, couples, and groups, providing counseling in Belfast, Ireland. Practicing in an integrative approach, he draws on cognitive behavioral therapy, person-centered, psychodynamic, and solution-focused approaches to maximize support for clients. He has experience working with issues such as trauma, chronic illness, abuse, personality disorder, addiction, obsessive-compulsive disorder, depression, anger, anxiety, relationship issues, and bereavement. Darren is author of the book, Surviving Other People's Self-Esteem. He has a popular YouTube channel where he discusses topics focusing on relationships, mental health, and personality. Darren McGee, you are very, very welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you very much for having me on your podcast. It's a pleasure to be here.
Darren, this is, well, the topic to introduce it to the guys listening in, it'll have been in the title, where I am personally curious to go deep in on, under whatever comes up naturally under the title, how to set strong boundaries with boundary violating in-laws. And there's a little bit of the part of, you know, in marriage, us husbands, we can very often like to put it on the in-laws. You know, it's very easy to project it on, but I also would humorously and sincerely open guys up and the conversation up. It's not just on the in-laws, it's our own families as well. That can be like an uncomfortable part to admit in marriage. But I really wanted to go deeper. I will have the links for the guys in the podcast description, but it was your beautiful YouTube channel. Now it covers so many beautiful topics, but the topic of narcissism was definitely showing up for myself personally and in my work. To kick us off, could you give a definition of what narcissism is? What's it about?
Well, narcissism, it sounds quite unpopular when I say this. All of us have levels of narcissism. Narcissism at its very basic is our own self-interest, in the sense that we want to have the best life that we can. We might go to college, we might go to university, we might learn a trade because we're seeing further down the road. We want to have a reasonable quality of life. You go on a first date with someone, you want to look your best. You're hoping they're going to like you, you know. So there are healthy levels of narcissism. What we refer to as a narcissist is something different. It's there's many different kinds, many different shades, and it's like any kind of personality type. It's like a spectrum, okay? At its very basic, you have something quite low level. That would be someone who's maybe just quite self-absorbed. Every time you're having a conversation, it's about them. It's about they have the best toys, they have the best car, they have whatever. Things about them. And then you move through that spectrum right up to, if you will, what would be a disorder. And when you think of a disorder, I think of a disorder as the impact that has on someone's day-to-day functioning, the impact it has on their relationships with themselves as well as other people. Doesn't have to be a disorder. It can be comorbid with many other things. It's the narcissism is very, very deeply ingrained, not quite enough there for a diagnosis for a personality disorder, but very deeply ingrained traits. What we would call a narcissist would be characterized by someone who has a huge sense of entitlement. They are very self-absorbed. They can be very disagreeable. There is a lack of empathy for other people. And depending on how it presents, they can be highly resistant or highly sensitive to any form of criticism. Now, criticism does not have to mean teasing or having to go at them or whatever. The criticism could even be just something as simple as telling them no. It could be something as simple as pointing out one of their errors. So there's a lot goes on with narcissism. Narcissist is not, it's a term that's used a lot, but it's not necessarily someone we don't get on with. It's not necessary. It's like the boss doesn't give you next Tuesday off. They're not a narcissist, but we're very angry and we might say they are a narcissist. Narcissism, as I say, it's quite a construct. There's a lot to it.
Yeah, that's a beautiful introduction, Darren. Thank you for that. And I love how you're setting it up. It's in all of us, because I know, you know, working with men, and I won't project it onto the guys listening in, I know within myself, when I came to, if you want to say, inner work initially, there was so much of my mind used to love these terms and hearing characteristics about other dysfunctional people, you know, the others. And my mind felt so empowered with, oh, it's like I was this underqualified, completely, not even underqualified, completely unqualified psychiatrist, psychologist, counselor, you name it. I could name the disorders of the world, but bringing it home to myself. So I just love that universal nature. To give a little bit of context, like to you, Darren, and to guys listening in, there's a part of my intention coming in here is like, from your videos, Darren, we'll speak about, you know, sort of characteristic narcissistic people, and it's mainly the narcissistic family dynamics. You know, you marry into a family, the in-laws we'll use as the topic, as the subject of it. We might caricature it because I feel sort of if you go to the, maybe not the extreme, but like quite a characteristic narcissistic family, in-laws you marry in, we'll caricature it. So it'll bring up the greatest amount of contrast that guys listening in can relate to or not. But again, just you've spoke to it beautifully. There's a whole spectrum there. You sort of started nudging into it from, you know, in the definition, Darren, of, you know, what narcissism is and certain signs of, you know, how narcissism can show up behaviorally in a person. But what would be classic characteristics of a narcissistic family? You know, what could guys expect? Like if there was a list of red flags of behaviors and signs, and call them symptoms, in, you know, in their in-laws, in their family that they're married into, to go, wow, oh, that this is what I'm actually dealing with. What would these guys be noting?
Well, first of all, when we talk about red flags, all of us, you know, the warning signs, the red flags, all of us can behave in certain ways from time to time. And I think that it's important to recognize someone might have an off day. They might have a bad day. Doesn't necessarily mean they're bad. So what we're often looking at are repeated patterns of behavior. If it's not the same thing, it is the same kind of thing. So we're looking at repeated patterns of behavior. You try to reason with them. You try to explain to them. They either just keep doing the same thing, or there is just a different approach to try to do the same thing. That's looking at it from the outside, okay? But looking at it from the inside, a family, a narcissistic family, commonly, not in every single case, but commonly, they operate like a cult. And when I say a cult, again, it's not a term that I use lightly. It operates like a cult because you think of the dynamics of a cult. What you have is someone at the head. In a family, it's either going to be the matriarch or the patriarch. It's the mum or the dad. Sometimes it's both, but more commonly it would be one of them. So you have that person at the head. Then you have someone else, maybe usually the other partner, who would be, if you will, an enabler. Now, they're not necessarily an enabler, as in they just give them everything they want because they worship them. They're absolutely amazing. It could be they're enabling them because they think it's the best thing to do. They've been with that person for a long time. So they've maybe been, for want of a better term, they've been brainwashed. Then you have the kids. And with the kids, you often have, it's quite common with narcissism, it's that old tactic of divide and conquer. So you have the children would have different roles as well. Now, just for the sake of this discussion, I'm going to go with three children. Some only have one, some might have 10, but just going to go for the sake of three children, just to outline the different types of roles. You might have what's known as a golden child. The golden child, we think of the spoiled child. It can be, but not necessarily, because the golden child is not immune to the narcissism, the outrage, the guilt tripping, the shaming, things like that. They're not immune to it. They suffer with it as well, or suffer from it rather. But they're the golden child in the sense that they are set apart from the other children. The other children are often compared unfavorably to that child. Be more like them. Sometimes they are the spoiled rotten child to get all the best toys. Then you would have another child that's commonly referred to as the scapegoat. And the scapegoat child is the child that's often blamed on all the family's misery. They are at fault for everything that goes wrong. You might have another child, there's different roles. You might have a child would be referred to as maybe the lost child, or they could be the hero child. These are different roles. Lost child would be the child that's almost forgotten about. They're hidden in plain sight. They don't want necessarily the hassle of being the golden child. They would like to have the regard and so on, but they don't necessarily want to outshine the golden child either. They might be punished. They don't want to be the scapegoat either, because they see what the scapegoat has to put on. So they kind of hide in plain sight. The hero child, the child in that role is the child who tries to present to the world that we're a normal, happy family. They may make excuses for the other kids who are misbehaving. They may make excuses. Let's imagine there's maybe an addiction or something there. They present to the world as if everything is fine, they're happy. So there's all these different dynamics going on, and the parent sometimes is pitting the children against each other. They are not just trying to get that parent's positive regard. They're also trying to avoid the wrath, the punishment, the unkind humor. Another aspect of it being like a cult. So you think of any cult, not just talking about, you know, people who like a certain sci-fi show or something, to talk about the cult of Star Trek, the cult of Doctor Who. No, that's more just like a group of people who are into the same thing. The way a cult operates is it's very secretive. Nobody gets to see. It's only on the inside you get to see what it's really like. To the outside world, it's amazing. It's really good. It's the best thing ever. You get a family that operates like that. Maybe they're at church every Sunday. Maybe they're doing really good work in the community. Maybe they are, you know, helping the poor. They have this public image. It's behind closed doors that all the chaos is taking place. And everybody has to buy into that. The kids, particularly that hero child, the kids are trying to present to the world that everything is normal. Parents are presenting to the world that everything is normal. And within that cult system as well, you don't get the question. People in cults don't get the question. None of this makes any sense. If we're so happy and normal, why is this going on? Why are we all so miserable? You're telling me that I must behave like this, but why? There's never anything in it for me. All I ever do is get punished, whether I do it or not. So like a cult, you don't get the question, the narrative. You're not allowed to question the narrative. It's just, it is what it is. You exist. You think of that narcissistic parent. You exist to service me. You exist to make me look good. And the last reason, the last thing about a cult is, what makes a narcissistic family like a cult? Like any cult, you're not allowed to leave. You think of any cult in the world, doesn't matter what it is. You think of the people that have tried to leave, the way the cult has come after them. Try to destroy their reputations, destroy their character. Very, very much like a narcissistic person will do. Once you break contact with them, once you break away from them, once you leave them. So you get that whole concept of smear campaigns and recruiting their agents, what's commonly referred to as flying monkeys, trying to destroy that person's character, their reputation, trying to isolate them. So when I say a narcissistic family operates like a cult, and what sounds very graphic when I put it into that kind of context, but a lot of cases, that's how they do operate.
It's so revealing, Darren. And I totally get on a personal basis, both through my own lens of my own family of origin and different dynamics, it actually shocked me how much I could relate with your videos. It really took me by surprise. I've known it for a long while in deep men's work, where it's like, for so many levels, it's like I thought I had the perfect childhood. If you were to have asked me, you know, when I was 17, 18, 19, I was like, oh, perfect. You know, all needs met, lots of fun, lots of joy, lots of laughter. You know, and like, in many senses, there was. But it was not obvious. You know, there was nothing obvious about this. You know, there was no sexual abuse. There was no physical violence. There was no crazy, you know, misuse of alcohol or drugs, et cetera, et cetera. There's like, parents stay together. And yet, when you get to what initially seemed like subtleties, where a part of my nervous system was like, oh, maybe there's something there. The longer I've really leaned into it, I'm like, wow, it's not so subtle at all. It's actually when it's explicitly broken down like you're doing. And I know for sure with my wife's family, I have a little bit more, I think, leeway, because they're from Italy, so they're definitely not going to be listening in. So I've been very explicit with this in the safety of my men's group and with my wife and that. But it's like, oh my fucking God. You know, when you talk about that cult, that secretive element of like, there's no questions. I know when I went in, I moved to, just to give you a little bit of context, Darren, I much prefer like a keep it. You're introducing beautiful, the theory, but just to bring it to life. Like vicariously with the guys listening in, is when I went down to Italy, I lived there for 2.5 years, and I was the hero because I brought a member back to the cult. Matilda, we met in Ireland. I brought her back home. So initially I thought I was a god, but the secretive part where, you know, the inside, on the inside walls of that house, what went on, what didn't go on, it was really dramatic. And I obviously from the outside was the one that started bringing questions in. I was the outsider. I could see, hold on, you know, this is like, is this how it works? You know, I brought questions to Matilda, etc. And you exist to serve me. I totally get that. And like, not allowed to leave. Oh my. I was the one that was questioning it. And ultimately, we were there 2.5 years. And when, you know, I finally said to Matilda, it's like, we can't stay here. Literally, we had... Anya was just born. Well, she was born. She was maybe like a year and a half old at that stage. And I got to the point, and I did not, it got that bad. Back then I had such a drastically small connection with my own needs and how to express them. Yet it got that bad. I just knew, I looked at Matilda. I was like, we can't go on here. It's like, if we go on here, if we pretend to stay here, it's like us as a family unit, yourself, myself and Anya, we're not going to be together. It's just got that much. It got that bad. So I just wanted to bake in a little bit of just tangible life experience. Just I don't want to, you know, the guys listening in, it's very real and live in my nervous system, my experience of this. And I just want to share it with you directly, Darren. So I'm you're ticking every single box in so many ways in my own personal experience.
Mark, that's very interesting you say that. Just picking up on something you said there about your own needs, and what's common in narcissistic dynamics is through a process of erosion, it's often a little piece at a time, we start to put other people's needs in front of them, usually the narcissistic person. And it's not in your face. It's not, if you think of going on a date with someone for the first time, if you were to go on a date with someone and they were to tell you, before you even tell me about your friends, I've already told you I don't like them, so I don't want you hanging around with them. By the way, I don't like your beard. You're going to have to lose that. And, you know, if they were to talk to you like that, you know there's not going to be a second date. So what we often get is a little small piece at a time. Things get eroded. Our boundaries get eroded. And after a while, you realize your own needs, your own sense of reality has been eroded away so much, you're putting someone else's needs in front of your own. And sooner or later, we do wake up to that. I think a lot of people do. We wake up to it, but the question is then, where do we go with it? But I just thought it was interesting you pointed out about your own sense of needs. It's like you were ignoring your own needs for someone else.
Oh, Darren, like you've picked up perfectly on that. I know speaking with the guys before, like the Mr. Nice Guy persona, I mentioned Robert Glover's book, and he's not the only person that speaks exclusively on that. Completely. Like when you said the words process of erosion, there was another part of my nervous system going, oh my God, Darren, you're just, you're knifing my persona, definitely the persona of early marriage. It just, that was it. That just characterizes my first few years. And it got to such a point for me where, like I think you were pointing to, I got in so deep, Darren, that it's like I didn't know how to claw back. And it was like I can only say it's like, you know, like is it in space, a black hole where it just sucks everything into it. I sort of humored it in the beginning. There was this, I now know it's like this subconscious, didn't trust my own voice, didn't feel, you know, it was like self-love and acceptance, etc. I do know that. But, you know, at the time, I had this naive part of my mind going, you know, but if I just keep showing up being a nice guy, if I keep showing up being loving, if I keep showing up being positive, at some point, you know, my beautiful wife, Matilda, and at some point by extension, her family. But it's like, well, that clearly never happened. And that process of erosion got to the point where I didn't know who the hell I was. And I'm still unpacking that. I would literally say like the last three and a half years, I had a breakthrough marriage experience a few years ago. The guys, this is where the podcast was birthed from, Darren, but I've been unpacking that process of erosion of my sense of self ever since. And there's still every day bits that come up going, hey, like I've forgotten who I was. Like this marriage is not based on who I was. And from direct with Matilda, but with the focus of this conversation, a lot of external influences from us of sort of intruding family members, both side with their opinions, how to do shit, how to, like, we've ended up, we're homeschooling, we're vegetarian, we left the church, we're deeply spiritual. I actually follow, I think, and try to embody the teachings of Jesus more than ever, but I don't go to church. There is tons of every single one of the main social institutions and traditional paths we've went away from. So we've experienced a lot of kickback and intrusion from family. So yeah, I just wanted to say that when again you're speaking just to the core of everything that has been dysfunctional. So I'm appreciating your expertise.
That's okay. It's again, it's not uncommon we lose our sense of selves. I think people are inherently, for want of a better way of putting it, good by nature, nice by nature. We like to be accommodating. It's just in our nature, but there are people, narcissistic types. Again, they prey on a lot of the time the empathy and compassion of others.
Darren, I think a natural progression here. There were two terms in one of your videos, particularly that perked my ears up. It sounded quite technical in language, but what I'd love you to do is unpack them and to bring them into life for guys listening in and for myself. Your descriptions on the videos really did that job, but these ideas of pseudo-mutuality and pseudo-hostility in families, that was just revelatory for me when I was listening to your videos. Could you unpack those, what they mean, and like what guys can look out for, like what they look like in the flow of these style of family dynamics?
Well, pseudo-mutuality, I would look at that in two ways, but the term itself, it means conflicts and views, opinions, things like that. They're solved, they're resolved by ignoring them. If you don't talk about it, it's not there. Okay, so there is that sense of pseudo-mutuality. And that could be for different reasons. It could be, you know, arguing's just too painful. So if we ignore it, it'll go away. Truth is, it doesn't go away. Things tend to get worse. In a narcissistic family, it's still the same. Within that dynamic, arguments over things like fairness, you know, being listened to, being heard. The kids, even the partner on a lot of occasions, they, tapping into what we said a moment ago, they ignore their own needs. They ignore their own needs because the head of the family, the matriarch or the patriarch, they're like the center of the universe. It's what they think and what they feel is most important. So they ignore anything that's going on in order for that. Another aspect of pseudo-mutuality, it's like when they all buy into the same narrative. We are a great family. We're a wonderful family. And the reality is they're just like any other family. They're flawed. You know, a lot of families are more like the Simpsons than they are the Waltons. Do you ever want to acknowledge it? You know, we narcissistic families, they just want to present this ideal family. So the pseudo-mutuality, another aspect of that is when they're all buying into the same thing. Pseudo-hostility is how they actually deal with disagreement. And you would get this with kids. Now, kids do this anyway, by the way. They bicker. They fight. They argue over toys. You know, you think of kids, you know, you're driving along. The kids are in the back of the car and one of them's arguing. They're on my half of the car. They're looking out my window. You know, kids do that sort of thing anyway. In a narcissistic family, it's almost like any contention is dealt with bickering, gossiping, getting the other person into trouble with the parents. And it's also that hostility, that pseudo hostility, it acts like a buffer against anything that brings up any kind of anxiety or distress. In narcissistic families, things like validation and connection, affection, a lot of the time these things are conditional. Kids are learned, they are conditional. They have to look a certain way, they have to be a certain way in order to get it. And that kind of bickering amongst themselves is a way, it's like a buffer, it's like a shield against any kind of intimacy and affection. Because the only type of intimacy and affection they've learned is they have to earn it from that parent. There is a need for tendency. Like all kids, like all human beings, we have a need for connection. We have a need to feel heard, to feel listened to, even if it's just for the sake of feeling seen. So there is a need for tenderness and so on, but it's often concealed due to the discomfort of how they get it from the narcissistic parent. So not sure if that answers those two questions, but I hope that
it's beautifully answered. The pseudo-mutuality, the conflicts and views resolved by ignoring them. It's more of my own story, just going, oh, that's just taking that box. And I know coaching with guys, definitely. And you know, like the important thing here, like just to give a bit of context to guys going in, and to you, Darren, like everything, it's almost like the mantra here is, you know, the way to be the husband she brags about, but it's like on a deepest level is to show up and embody extreme ownership. What I'm thinking here of just context here is, of course, in this conversation, we're speaking a lot about, you know, we're speaking a lot about the others, if you want to say us, you know, showing up as a husband, and then there's these other people intruding in. But there's a lot of this. I just want to build in that context of, it's not about the others ultimately. And I if you can speak to this from your terms of, and I'm quite sure, you know, the therapeutic healing path with you is like about regaining your core power. I just want to build this in sort of relatively early in the conversation, because again, it just within the ethos of this podcast, but I think healing in the deepest level is to make sure that guys listening in, that there's no escape route of, yeah, you know, everything Darren is saying and Mark was talking about, there's those bastards over there, and they're I recognize every single dynamic that's wrong with them, and like there's 20 things Darren said. Yes, they are a shower of absolute, like, you know, fill in the blanks with all the flowery language. And yes, that can be true. I know for me, there's a lot of validity. Yet I just want to bake in a bit of context, or could you bake in a bit of context? Because I'm going to be speaking about or asking you about boundary setting and how to navigate with other people, with in-laws that do not respect your boundaries. But Darren, could you speak to, you know, where's the core? What words of wisdom do you have for guys listening in that maybe at this point, Darren, they're already going, yeah, I really resonate with what Darren is saying, you know, and like some of Mark's experience, like, yeah, like, you know, me too. What's the most important inner frame of reference for guys, husbands listening in that are resonating with what's being presented to come from within themselves as individual men? Does that make sense? I just want to build a real ground under every person's feet, including myself.
Not much of an ask. What I will say is, when I work with couples, a lot of different things come up. But what I often say, and it's not just the man, but it's to the woman as well, or it could be a same-sex relationship, but the individual, I would say. There's two things to think about. Well, a lot of things, but two main things in a relationship. First of all, there's a minimum of two of you in it. Therefore, it takes two of you to make it work. The second part of that is responsibility. And I will split that into two pieces. Taking responsibility for ourselves. We are responsible for our own actions, our own thoughts, our own feelings. We're also responsible for the impact we have on other people. Now, this is where this separates from narcissism, because with narcissistic people, it's everybody else's fault. There is no responsibility. So we need to take responsibility for ourselves, but within a relationship, we also have to pay attention to joint responsibility. As I said, there's a minimum of two people in it. Therefore, it takes two people to make it work. So we have to take responsibility, not just for the things we do and say, but for the impact we have. Again, the difference with narcissism, when we're taking responsibility for ourselves, I think we need to pay attention to the qualities that are within us that we're not comfortable with. And if we don't pay attention to those qualities that we're not comfortable with, a lot of the times we'll just keep on repeating the same things and we will project it on the other people. It's their fault. They made me, et cetera, et cetera. When we take responsibility for ourselves, when we recognize those qualities within ourselves, you might have someone who has a temper. Well, if they take responsibility for that, they recognize there are some things make them angry. When they understand why they get angry, for example, they feel something's really unfair, they're feeling threatened, they feel embarrassed, they see some kind of injustice, someone very close to them is being threatened somehow. When they get an understanding of what that anger is, they can take responsibility for it and they can act in an appropriate way. It's not about not being angry. It's never about not being angry. It's about being angry with the right person in the right time and in the most appropriate way.
This is juicy. This is when my nervous system, I know, since I'm getting more in contact with my body, Darren, it's like when a rippling wave of enthusiasm comes up, I know I'm after hearing some epic shit. I love your words of advice, where for guys to look out, if I've heard you correctly, to look out for the qualities we're not comfortable with. And I, again, for guys, and I think there's so many guys out there, we've through trauma-inducing society, as Jiddu Krishnamurti said, you know, the profoundly sick society that just had no real empathy or good old-styled, indigenous-style upbringing, you know, that just had the person at the center, you know, that it was like a thriving person. Society was meant to exist for a person to thrive. And so much has went sort of contrary to that, where we have disregarded our the wisdom of anger.
And yeah, if we feel it, anything we feel at all, we feel it for a reason. When we understand what that reason is, when we actually, whenever we can name what it is, a lot of times we'll say angry. A lot of times we'll say anxious. When we go that little bit deeper, well, what I feel uncertain. I feel a lack of control here. I feel confused. Sometimes, you know, I feel excited. When we get a sense of what it is we really feel, we're in a better position to be able to regulate it. And again, this thing about responsibility, we're taking responsibility for our own thoughts, our own feelings, our own actions. The joint responsibility as well. It's true in any relationship, but we'll just stick with, say, a marriage at the moment between a couple. The joint responsibility, I think, is sometimes we have to recognize the other person knows something we don't. So we have to listen to them. They have seen something we haven't. Do you know what I mean? And we learn, I suppose, the art of negotiation, the art of trade-off. We're not always going to get what we want by just demanding it. So we have to think of what am I prepared to give in order to get what I need or what I want.
What comes up on this topic when you're saying that, Darren, that the other person, you know, Matilda in this case, she was seeing certain dynamics as I was relating with mm-hmm. what obviously were in-laws for her, and I was seeing in her the way she would completely change her way of behaving. Like the Matilda would show up in the kitchen with me in the privacy of her own home. We're feeling inspired, we're feeling safe, and we're speaking about our future. And then, you know, we'd fly to Italy. Same conversation, same topic, mm-hmm. totally different Matilda, totally different. Like she everything mm-hmm. would change. It was like a different person. That's what was really showing up for me. Where on this topic of dealing with in-laws, for many years, Matilda could see how out of whack I was showing up. I was losing my core as a man. There was none of Mark, you know, the real Mark that she knew, the authentic man, the man that could, little by little, it was like maybe not on tap in the beginning, but she knew that there was a certain power I had. Mm. But when I stepped into my family of origin dynamics, it's like that Mark just went. I maybe technically dissociated, but I just, it was a different man altogether. So I feel a great wisdom in what you're saying. And, you know, for guys listening in, you know, if your wife is noticing stuff in you, she's probably noticing really well, no more than you can notice in her, how she relates with her family. There's great wisdom in that.
They're what we would refer to as our blind spots. So the parts in us that others can see that we can't. Just like we can see blind spots in other people, we have to be aware that we have our blind spots as well.
Mm. And Darren, you know, with what you're laying forward, you know, this looking out for qualities that we're not comfortable with, you know, mm-hmm. certain trusting, I suppose, trusting our gut instincts, that you brought it to the anger. And I know from joining men's work, the most simple definition of anger that I have just hung on to, there's probably a lot greater depth in behind it with somebody with your expertise, but anger is the emotion of boundary setting. I just have loved that. It's like it made it sort of black and white and simple in my mind. If guys listening in to this now are, you know, through the conversation, they're beginning to pick up and allow themselves to permission vicariously to go, I have been picking up on this. I have had a moment-to-moment awareness of some part of me going, you know, sort of fuck no, hell no. That's just not on. These characteristics, the way, you know, my in-laws, be it the siblings in it, be it the parents, be it one of the parents, et cetera, et cetera, the way they express and judge and violate boundaries, it's just not on. I've always known it, but I haven't known how to navigate it. So I've sort of suppressed that. But this conversation, it's flooding forward. They're like, okay, I'm feeling like with this awareness, I need to do something different. And setting boundaries is like the road to doing that or beginning. First and foremost, again, bringing it down to its simplest form. What is a boundary? How would you describe that to guys in the simplest manner?
Well, when you think of boundaries, there are going to be different kinds of boundaries. So let's think of a physical boundary. we would have a physical boundary. We do not particularly want someone standing too close to us. We don't want their face too close to us whenever they're speaking. There would be other physical boundaries in the sense, think of our property. We do not particularly want strangers playing in our front garden. We don't want them coming in and watching our television. You know? So there's different kinds of boundaries. There's emotional boundaries. There's intellectual boundaries, psychological boundaries, financial boundaries. Other people don't get to spend our money, not without our permission. So there are different kinds of boundaries. To recognize our boundaries, if you will, our personal boundaries, you think of things like your values, your value system. You think of your limits. We only have so much capacity. We can't work a 26-hour day, you know, things like that. We need rest. We need our own private space. We need privacy. We also have our integrity. We're not necessarily going to go do something that goes against our moral compass. We're not going to lie for somebody just because they're in trouble. That would go against, again, our moral code, but that would go against our integrity as well. We think of our self-respect as well. Now, the thing about boundaries is recognizing that other people have them as well. And chances are, more often than not, we will respect their boundaries. How do we know what their boundaries are? Because we might think some boundaries are maybe a given. In other words, we're not going to steal from them. So we don't expect them to steal from us. So some boundaries may be a given. Sorry about that, just coughed. So some boundaries may be a given, but other boundaries, it's the thing about crossing boundaries. Some people will cross your boundaries, but they don't know they're crossing them because you haven't told them. Going back to what I said a moment ago about responsibility, it's our responsibility to make it clear to someone that what they're asking is perhaps unreasonable or unfair. Because if they don't know, they're going to keep on doing it. So recognizing your boundaries, those different kinds of boundaries, personal, physical, emotional, financial, recognizing the things that come up, things like our values, our limits, our integrity, and so on. And then having the confidence, the assertiveness to be able to communicate them. We don't need to be rude. We don't need to be stern. We don't need to be harsh. We can just be clear and concise. The same way as you could with somebody in work. Same way you could with your best friend. Most people are going to respect them. They're going to hear them. It's again, it's just those maybe narcissistic types that will keep trying to cross them.
And coming from there, Darren, let's say, again, just the conversation is deepening. Guys are like, okay, I've had that feeling in my nervous system. Now Darren is speaking about boundaries. It's like, yes, my values, my sense of self-respect, integrity, my limits are being tested all the time. So there's this growing awareness. There's a willingness to set a boundary. There's two curiosities I have, and I leave it. I don't know which is the best one to start with. How do you not go about setting a boundary? I think we all try to set them, but what are the classic ways that you have so many people coming in into you going, oh, but Darren, like, you know, you might ask the question, well, do you set boundaries with them? And what are the attempts that people make that they think they're setting a boundary, but it's the last thing that's ever going to work? What would that look like in general? I know everybody is going to have idiosyncratic ways of it, but if there's some general patterns that guys can go, oh shit, okay, that I'm doing that, I'm trying to set a boundary, but that's never going to work.
Well, I suppose what comes to mind would be if we were setting a boundary, let's say it's not an unreasonable one. It might be something like, I'm not prepared to do that. I'm not going to lie for you, whatever. So that would be a boundary. I'm not going to lie for you. If someone were to communicate that, and they would do it in a way almost as if they're apologizing. Let's think of it this way. Do you ever go into one of those shops where you get somebody on the phone and they're trying to sell you something that pretty much made their mind up you're buying it, whether you want it or not? It doesn't matter what you say, they keep coming back with something.
Yes, yes, I definitely have had that experience.
Yeah, I seem to get it at least twice a week. I don't know why they pick on me. But yeah, they pretty much decided you're going to buy it whether you need it or not. You can't afford it. You don't need it. You don't want it. And yet they keep on going. And what you have to do, it's almost like you have to explain to them. But no, I don't have the money. And then they come back with, oh, we have a payment plan. I don't really need it. But you just said, you know, what they're trying to do is they're trying to grind you down. This is what people do often when they're crossing boundaries, when they're, if they can't just openly cross it, keep grinding them down until you don't have any boundaries. We don't need to apologize for saying no. Sometimes that's a complete sentence. We can give an explanation. No, I won't do that for you. That goes against my values. You're asking me to lie for you. We don't necessarily need to go any further than that. They keep on asking why. They keep on asking why. The more we explain ourselves, the more we're getting caught up in this sometimes nonsensical kind of word salad. The more we try to justify ourselves, the more we're actually being ground down. It's just like the salesman. We just keep saying to that salesperson, whoever they are, I'm not interested. Still not interested. Not interested. Sooner or later, they tend to back off. They'll hang up the phone. They'll go and ring the next person. Sometimes with other people, it's the same thing. And I call it the broken record approach. We just keep saying the same thing. It doesn't matter what they pick up on. Doesn't matter what they say. It doesn't matter. They could roll about in the floor in front of you, clutching their throat and wailing. The world might as well end. We just say the same thing. We can give an explanation. We can give an account, but we don't have to go any further than that. I think when we keep on explaining, it's almost going back to said about being earlier, people are generally nice. They're generally accommodating. Justifying the no. Trying to pacify the other person, almost thinking, can I give them something else instead that'll keep them quiet and happy? It's difficult and it takes practice if you're not used to doing it, but and there's different ways. There is therapy, there is coaching, as I'm sure you're aware, something you've probably worked with people on. Practicing different ways of just saying no, saying the same thing over and over again. Does take practice, but it pays off in the long run.
So it boils down, and it's actually beautiful, because I know working with men all the time, Darren, is by nature and nurture in this society. So often guys lean in on, if we go from an archetypal position, the magician archetype, the rational mind. And it's, I know guys, when working with guys, I use that as, I keep telling guys, hey, like trauma, nature and nurture, doesn't matter. That like, that's the tool that is sharpened the most. So where I get excited there from a mechanistic perspective is like you're almost bottling it down to two main behavioral categories, you know, for guys to that are listening in to go, okay, just if you notice yourself outwardly apologizing and I suppose inwardly apologizing. I know myself, I might have been saying, oh, sorry, but the energetic was apologizing. It's like there was a part of me feeling so bad that I was making them feel bad. It was like, I'm telling them no, so clearly they're not going to be happy. I took that as like this inherent failure. Yeah, it's like I've done something wrong, and I've unpacked it. Probably tons more unpacking to do, but I've definitely linked it back childhood. It's like I wasn't engendered with this open, beautiful, open-hearted, open-minded, beautiful safety that, yes, Mark, you can say no, because saying no is you saying yes to you, to your needs, to your personhood, et cetera, et cetera. So I ended up feeling like I just owed everybody an apology. And then as a natural result is like the justifying came. So guys listening in, mechanistic, superpower, you know, rational mind, lock it in. If you notice yourself apologizing inward or outwardly and going down the path of justifying, they're two big no-nos. If you want these disrespectful boundary violating in-laws of yours to actually start hearing you. So you're hearing it from Darren here direct. And well, with Darren's experience, definitely you can lean in. I mean, it's incredible the amount of experience you have. Darren, shifting over, and you were sort of naturally shifting into that with like the broken record style idea. Well, if no apologizing and no justifying, because they're just deeply psychologically, emotionally ineffective, definitely with somebody that's narcissistic, they're not going to listen to you anyway. So if they're totally ineffective, well, what's the other way? You know, and making the assumption here that we're actually dealing with somebody with ingrained, self-centered, narcissistic, don't really want to hear anybody else's perspective apart from myself.
A sense of entitlement.
Yes. How do guys that are facing the full, you know, the full force of that sort of a disrespectful, boundaryless persona in their in-laws, how do they go at it in a way that can give them some levels of clarity and, you know, hopefully initial courage to do so? What's the best advice for them to take the initial steps?
Learn to trust yourself. Learn to trust yourself that you're going to get it wrong. You're going to make mistakes. In any kind of dynamic with a narcissistic person, they see things like mistakes and flaws as weaknesses, and they try to exploit them. So we're led to believe there's something wrong with us if we say mispronounce something or if we even change our mind. No, learn to trust yourself. It's okay to get it wrong. It's okay to make a mistake. This is on them. We, again, when we say no to someone, now it's okay, we can feel sympathy and we can feel empathy. It's not the answer they wanted. It doesn't matter what they asked for. We can see their disappointment, so we can feel a certain empathy, sympathy, compassion. That's fair enough. But we have to remember, we don't own that. That's not something we have done to them. Again, going back to the responsibility thing, they have to take responsibility for themselves if we say no. So what, because like I said a moment ago, we can give an explanation, but we don't have to go any further. We don't have to keep explaining ourselves. Something else to bear in mind is if this is someone with very deeply ingrained narcissistic traits, we don't expect them to change. And that's the uncomfortable thing. That's one of the things that makes it very difficult. We don't expect them to change. They might keep on asking. They might keep on going. They might keep on asking in different ways. They might think they can go ahead and do it anyway and there aren't any consequences. Again, that's when we have to be prepared to make mistakes in order to learn how to not just communicate but reinforce the boundaries. Now, how we go about that is going to be different. I'm not saying everybody has to barricade their house and stop people getting in. That's not what I'm suggesting. But finding different ways to reinforce our boundaries. Recognizing as well that where there is narcissism, our reactions are always going to be used as evidence of our insanity, of our cruelty. Which is why a lot of the time you will get someone provoking to the point where someone does react. And then it's the reaction that is focused on, not what they did to cause the reaction. So learning to respond rather than react. Whenever we react to something, we're all going to react. It's out there at the speed of light. But whenever we react to something, you know, verbally, physically, things like that, it's like the other person has control. Whenever we respond, which might be out there at the speed of sound, not quite as fast as the speed of light, but still fast enough. When we learn to respond, we have control. Again, that response could be, as I said a moment ago, we just say the same thing. I told you I'm not interested. Again, we're going to recognize their disappointment, their upset, and they may genuinely be, or it could be just a performance because they're used to guilt-tripping people. But when we see their disappointment, how will I phrase this? Yeah, I'll put it this way. To the best of my knowledge, disappointment isn't fatal. People generally get over it.
I'm loving that. It almost sounds insane to me now, Darren, looking back, you know, how disappointment isn't fatal. It sounds so black and white and logical now, yet that used to terrify me.
Yeah.
The core of my being as a man, it's like I had zero core early adulthood, early days with Matilda in relationship, but with in-laws, it was like, oh, the extreme levels, we don't have the time. I don't want to bore guys, but like the levels of minimizing and normalizing, I did. That was a term I learned by a guy, my first session in deep men's work, first men's circle facilitator of 30 years experience, that brilliant man. But he said that phrase. He's like, guys, you will never be, it'll never fail to surprise you the levels that us as men, we can minimize and normalize things that we don't enjoy in our lives.
Yeah.
And it's like, yes, I totally got that. I was minimizing, normalizing the amount that my entire persona was existing to please others. And thus I could never face emotionally that feeling of and disappointing somebody else. So I love that you're explicitly speaking to that. What I have a real curiosity about is you've mentioned immense, like the foundation under a guy's feet, you know, psychologically, is like trusting yourself. I love like the growth mindset, like you're going to get it wrong. You accept you'll make mistakes, the empathy, but it's like their reaction is on them and zero expectation for the person to change, etc. To live into that distinction, Darren, of respond versus emotionally react. What are there any repeatable, like that broken record, what I'm curious about, are there any repeatable phrases or foundational verbal statements that somebody can anchor in that are like, in your experience, some of like the most potent statements to support guys just go say the sentence, leave it at that? Are there any, you know, I know you can just say no, but I'm curious, are there any, you know, two or three or four sentences that you're like, yeah, that's a really powerful way to just deal with narcissistic energy?
Well, internally, you recognize this is their stuff, it's not mine. If you feel you're under pressure to answer, you're always probably going to go with the most expedient answer, as opposed to what's the right answer, if you know what I mean. So I think it can be helpful sometimes to, if you will, you just give yourself a little bit of space. Now, you can still answer straight away, but you're not giving them the answer they want. For instance, I'll think about it. I'll give it some thought. You haven't outright said no. Maybe you're buying yourself a little bit of time to catch your breath, to be able to say no. Now, chances are they're going to keep on going. They're going to keep on going. They're going to keep on talking, just like the salesperson who's trying to get you to buy. So we just keep repeating. I said I would give it some thought. You're not giving them any more. Remember, a lot of narcissistic people type, they feed off the energy that they create, both positive and negative energy, by the way. They feed off energy, so we don't give them the energy. It's the term I've been hearing over the past year or so, learning the art of stoicism. It's almost that non-emotional kind of response. It's factual. It's like Mr. Spock or whatever, you know. I said I would give it some thought. Again, you're just buying yourself that little bit of space to be able to say no. If you feel you're under pressure to give a yes or no straight away, if you feel yourself under pressure, chances are you've been conditioned to always say yes. Now, it's not true in every single case. I am speculating, but it's not uncommon. We've been conditioned to always say yes. So we just give ourselves that little bit of space. And just a simple line like, I will give it some thought. I'll think it over. I'll think about it. Whatever way you want to phrase it, can give you the space you need.
And if it comes to the point, so they've leaned in, they've taken a breath, they've given themselves some psychological space, and they'll end that. I'll think about it. I'll give it some thought. And maybe, I don't know how often this would ever have happened in my circumstances, but that space, as you have been pointing to, it tends to be eaten up. You know, the vociferous sort of insatiable appetite that I have experienced in with various family experiences and dynamics, that space doesn't tend to last for long, definitely in a live conversation. So let's say you're finding your ground. So we'll go, I'm trying to get like maybe not the worst case scenario, but the guys listening in, to practice that, it's already a pattern break. They're allowing themselves to depressurize. You know, I'll think about it. To get a couple of minutes, to get that bit of space, they're finding where they're coming from. I think earlier, just a reminder of earlier parts of, you know, what the wisdom you're speaking, they're touching base with their values in the moment. It's like, you know, questioning maybe, hey, I'm at my limit, maybe inner chatter, integrity and self-respect. So they've found their ground, but the person in front of them is still a bit insistent or very insistent. Are there any, like, if that's the first line of finding your ground, those sentences to find a space, what are there any other sentences? Maybe I'm being a bit focusing in on the details, but I'm trying to get guys that they can have tools that they can go away with.
I get what you're saying. Yeah. I think that, you know, I'll think it over. It does give you that bit of space, but yeah, chances are they are going to still keep coming at you. Now, even if it's in that same situation, it's almost, think of what I was saying, it's like that salesperson. They've already decided you're buying it. And you have to almost explain and apologize for why you're not. The more they go on, the more they go on at you. Well, I suppose, do you really have to give any response? You can just listen. Just listen to them. You're still not committing to anything. And if they get to the point where they're asking again, you just remind them, I already told you I would think about it. I'd think it over. If you're feeling confident enough, if you have gathered your ground, then if no is what you wanted to say, take a chance, take a risk, say it. See what happens. It might not go down well. At least you've said it. That's the thing about saying no. It's not always an easy thing to do. But what I would say is practice. If you have someone you feel comfortable enough with, tell them. I might sound a bit odd. I'm just trying to sound a bit more assertive. If you don't have anyone to practice with, if you're not seeing a therapist or a life coach, or you're not in some kind of support group, or you're not, you don't necessarily have that, just use the bathroom mirror. You did it when you were a teenager. You sang into a hairbrush into the mirror. Don't lie. Everybody did it. We all did.
Yes.
You know, it's the same thing. All you're doing is, for want of a better term, you're practicing your moves. What do you look like when you stand with your back straight, when you make eye contact, and you speak clearly and concisely? That's all you're doing. You're practicing. That little space, that little bit of space that you have, and they keep on going. If it is about feeling comfortable enough, then yeah, maybe you just take the risk and say no.
I love the practice element, Darren, that you're bringing in. And I know myself, actually, the greatest example for this is, like, for years, to be honest, maybe outside of, I didn't use it specifically for setting boundaries, but self-expression for me was always a major issue. It, like, sort of marred my early adult life, maybe my first decade as an adult, 20s, it was devastating in many senses, to the point of suicidal ideation. It was like, I just don't have any core, I don't have any truth, I don't have any right to exist, I'd rather just be off the face of this planet. It was to that level. So, but I've gotten to the point now where, you know, I do solo episodes every single week, speaking to powerful men like yourself, and, you know, by and large, holding my own, holding my space, anxieties, different things I'm aware of them when they come up, but just learning to just keep going on with it, really finding that ground. But this, the foundation was built on probably hundreds of hours of me giving, like, if you want to say, inspirational speeches. I'd be out, like, I'd bring the dogs for, you know, a 10, 15 minute walk every night. This is years. We've always had dogs, 15 years together. I'd be there for 10 or 15 minutes. And Matilda, I think I used to try and hide it in the beginning, but Matilda was like, were you talking to yourself out there? You know, and in the end, I actually just accepted. I was like, hey, this is what I do. I'm giving inspirational speeches to the world. This is long before I had a podcast. So I that has been invaluable for me, because it's like, it was giving me a pre-run in my nervous system multiple times over. And I know there's this in law of attraction teachings and in neurophysiology, it's like, the nervous system doesn't know the difference between inner reality and outer reality. So when you just keep practicing like that, it lines up. Like, you know, for people listening in, maybe it seems like a concept. I definitely felt silly in the beginning, hence hiding it from Matilda. But I've come to recognize peak performers. The Conor McGregor's definitely Conor on the way up. You know, peak performers do this. So it's a really potent tool to do a practice, the pre-rehearsals and lots of them.
Yeah, to imagine it is one thing. Absolutely, it's a good place to start. But whenever we start to practice, again, looking at yourself in the mirror, practicing with a friend, with a partner, whoever it is, we're actually hearing ourselves speak. And we're, if we're not looking at ourselves, we're looking at the people around us, how they are reacting to us. We're noticing that if we say no, or we be a bit assertive, or you know, whatever, no one's shocked, no one's angry, no one is, you know, they're actually listening. So we get to see those little things mirrored. Now, it doesn't mean that when we're in a difficult situation with a difficult kind of person that those things don't come up again, but we now also have a new memory to draw, a new physical memory as well.
Darren, I have to say, on this topic, there's been so much personal importance. Like, every single thing that you've said, I can resonate with. I love the advice, the guidelines, tried the whole lot. And just the second half of the conversation, really shifting in. I love it when guests come on and give very tangible takeaways. It's like, this is what you can use. It's like tools. It's like, you know, a builder. I always make the guys get it, like the toolbox. You know, a carpenter or a builder without a toolbox, I mean, it doesn't matter what experience you have. It doesn't matter what amount of enthusiasm you have. You just can't build anything without the tools, without the but you know, with your interview here, guys are going away with tools, with powerful foundational tools, and I'm really grateful to you for bringing your expertise on. Thank you so much for that.
I appreciate your asking me on. It's been a pleasure and a privilege to talk to you, Mark.
Darren, before you go, this is a major issue for a lot of guys, in-laws, etc., and guys could be tapping in that, you know, there's deeper issues within themselves, and a lot, I imagine, are resonating quite deeply with you as a man, as a therapist, and your information. Where can guys track you down online if they want to investigate working with you a little bit further, or following your teachings online?
Well, I have a YouTube channel. It just goes by my name, Darren F. McGee. I talk about mental health related topics. I talk about relationships. I talk about personality types. I've left the channel open, so I cover topics that the people ask me to cover. They suggest. The majority of the suggestions I get are about narcissism and narcissistic relationships. That's kind of how the channels went, but I do still talk about other things as well. I'm open to that. So there's a lot of information there. My website is sentientcounseling.co.uk. All my details will be on that.
Darren, thank you so much. And guys listening in, I will have the links as always in the podcast description. So if you're interested, you can follow up there. Coming into landing, Heroic Husbands around the planet. You're not alone. You know, this is a very, very common issue for, like, I've experienced myself with countless guys in men's groups around the world, cross-culturally, in my one-to-one coaching. And as Darren is leaning in, that's one of the most requested topics. So you're not alone. And the most important thing here, as always, is, you know, you have the tools available to you now. Transformation, you will always know, I remind you again and again on this, transformation isn't necessarily just in the listening, albeit that can be very beneficial. It's in the implementation. If this topic has, you know, is something that's showing really live in your marriage, in your day-to-day life, and it's impacting you, you now have the tools. And I do, you know, strongly, I challenge you. The masculine core is the direct call to challenge and action. I challenge and invite you to listen again and again to the episode, listen to the different ideas, the very practical tools that Darren has generously offered us all here, and take courageous steps. Put whatever ideas you feel called to, put them into action with the greatest courage available to you. And that's where the transformation happens. Just a reminder why we do what we do here. Better husbands today, better world tomorrow. Go have an amazing kingly day.